Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking with a remarkable mind a little later on the program about the need for the ethics of holism. Professor Glenn Martin, professor of philosophy and religious studies, will be here. I like to look at what is being shared in the rest of the media, mainstream and alternative media, and see if we can get a different perspective. Today, we're going to take an in-depth look of why we should not be drilling in the Arctic Ocean and its fate if we do, and the Obama administration being complicit in this, from Tom Dispatch, Subhankar Banerjee. Also today, I'll take a look at the public comment period on government's plan to foment vaccine hysteria and mandate vaccination ends shortly. Why you should become involved. Did they tell you yet they want to see all adults now getting mandatory vaccines? Oh, yeah. You should have been ahead of that curve. It was so easy. It's like in chess. Nobody ever wins a game of chess by playing one move at a time. You play seven moves ahead, anticipating. If they were so good at mandating our children getting vaccines, do you think they would have stopped there when there was so much more profit to be made from mandating adults? How about this? You don't get your vaccines, you can't travel. That's one of the things they're talking about. We'll explore that. Also, a new report today, eat at your own risk. The flawed FDA risk assessments strengthened arguments for labeling GMOs. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. And I want to thank all of you all over the world and all the stations that carry this program. The numbers are increasing exponentially. In fact, I'm on the road. When I come back, I'll be premiering two new documentaries about 3 months apart. I have not discussed these two. I've been mentioning Manufacturing Madness. I have two under wraps that I did not want to leak out because of the sensitivity of it. I didn't want any of the people who could be exposed trying to stop it or threaten or intimidate people I would be interviewing. So, two very powerful documentaries back in about 6 weeks. But I want to thank the last time I heard, and I don't know what the figures are this week, but in 1 week, 7 days, seven single days, 26 million people came to the site. So we are sharing. There's a lot of interested people. Let's start with something that has been a big problem. For decades, people said chronic fatigue syndrome simply didn't exist because there was no single identified cause. And as a result, people were thought to have some form of psychosomatic problem, hypochondriac problem. Not true. The latest research from Columbia University School of Public Health, quote, researchers at the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School for Public Health identified distinct immune changes in patients diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, known medically as ME-CFS, systemic exertion intolerance disease. The findings could help improve diagnosis and identify treatment options for the disabling disorder, in which symptoms range from extreme fatigue and difficulty concentrating to headaches and muscle pain. This was published in the journal Science Advances and presented at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This immune signature represents the first robust physical evidence that chronic fatigue syndrome is a biological illness as opposed to a psychological disorder. And so millions of people suffer from it. And so what they found is this. I'll try to put this into lay language. there are human monoclonal antibodies on the market that can dampen levels of a cytokine called interleukin-17A that is among those the study shows were elevated in early stage patients. And the study suggests or shows that chronic fatigue syndrome may reflect an infectious hit-and-run event. What do I mean? Patients often report getting sick, sometimes from something as common as infectious mononucleosis or Epstein-Barr virus, but they never fully recover. And that is what is the exclamation point here. The new research suggests that these infections throw a wrench into the immune system's ability to quiet itself after the acute infection, to return to what we call homeostatic balance. The immune response becomes like a car stuck in high gear. Quote, it appears that the chronic fatigue syndrome patients are flush with cytokines until around the three-year mark, at which point the immune system shows evidence of exhaustion and cytokine levels drop. Early diagnosis may provide unique opportunities for treatment that likely differ from those that would be appropriate in later phases. So, here's what happens, and I'll make it overly simplified. How many times have you come down with something that just might be simple exhaustion? You work too late at night. Maybe you were studying for an exam. Maybe you were under stress because of some life condition. Maybe there was a person passing in your family, or you got the news that your mom's got Alzheimer's and your whole life's going to change. These are acute stressors, meaning we have not had time to adapt some response. So it hits us hard. Always separation, some trauma, some fear creates an acute response. So the body jumps right in there and its whole immune system goes on high alert. You're ready. Flight or fee, or flee or fight. That's what you're going to do. It's in every single human being and it's in virtually all the animal kingdom. You fight or you flee. Now those that cannot fight, then they are faster. There's some antelope that can leap 30 feet in a bound. And there are others that there's some cats like the cheetah that cannot compete for a kill against a lion or a leopard, but it's faster than them, therefore can hunt down smaller prey that wouldn't feed. And, you know, they can eat rabbits. They can eat... And so that's how nature compensates. An elephant can't run very fast, but boy, you don't want to screw with it because it's a whole lot of mean with those tusks and very few creatures one-on-one would ever take on. A gorilla is a bit vegan and calm, but nature provided it with the same weight as more weight than a lion. You don't want to see a lion taking on a gorilla. The gorilla will win because it's smarter and stronger. Yet the lion has the teeth. So every species has something that allows it to be different, to allow it to survive. Humans are different. We don't have the teeth, and we don't have the speed of a cat. We can't climb up a tree, and we can't burrow into the ground. So what we do is we have the ability to think. We can extend our thinking, and we can solve problems unless you get stuck into anxiety mode. And you're no longer in the moment. You're no longer conscious. You're simply reactive. And that means we're almost always going to make bad choices. Almost everyone who makes decisions from acute anxiety makes the wrong choice. So now you're in acute anxiety or you're in acute stress, and your body can't calm down. It stays elevated. And when you stay elevated, it's like sitting at a stoplight with your foot on the brake and revving the gas. And you got both going simultaneously. You're going to burn out the engine. So at the end of 3 years, you've burned out your engine. you've never been vitally healthy, but you haven't been completely depleted in bed. You kind of stay in that area where you don't have the energy, you don't have the get up and go, you don't have the vitality that you normally would have. At a certain point, you exhaust your adrenal glands, you exhaust your pancreas, you exhaust the ACT levels, your mitochondria become exhausted, and literally you spend 16 to 18 hours a day in bed, which itself shortens your lifespan. People who sleep more than 8 hours a night shorten their lifespan. And so that's why when people say, I don't know what's wrong, Doc, I'm exhausted. The doc looks, doesn't find a particularly high level of a virus or bacteria, and says, well, I can't find anything here. Clearly, you know, yours is psychosomatic. And then frequently puts a person on tranquilizers that only exacerbates the problem. So now we know. Now, interesting, because how I've been helping people with chronic fatigue syndrome for a long time is on three levels. First and foremost, you take anything that can depress the immune system out, and then you rebalance the immune system with homeopathy. Your first and foremost approach should be energy medicine, because what you're dealing is you're taking a body that has exhausted its energy, and you have to rebuild it back up on a subtle level, organ by organ. Then, including with the thyroid gland, and then you energize the person by putting them on a very high oxygen-based food regimen, juices. The highest level would be wheatgrass juice, and 3, 4, 5 times a day, and then folic acid and methylated B12 and PPQ and Q10, all the nutrients we know provide energy and methyl donors, trimethylglycine, to the body. And you keep away anything that can overstimulate the immune system or depress the immune system. So in effect, you bring it back up. And then when you see viral activity that is still there, then you can go in with different therapies, and like an intravenous vitamin therapy, and deal with the virus or bacteria and recolonize the gut. So I'm glad they finally resolved that. Now, for those who are athletic, you want to make sure that you get a good workout in. From the University of Cambridge, they have found that nitric oxide, remember I've been talking a lot about beet juice, because if you have 6 ounces of beet juice in the morning, you really have a better workout. Here's what they say. Quote, new research from FASEB journal suggests that nitrate, a nitric oxide metabolite, meets tissue oxygen demands without the side effects of increasing red blood cells or blood viscosity. And then they talk about how you get a better workout. And so let's go right back to what I said. Have yourself some beet juice and have that cut 8 ounces of beet juice and 8 ounces of coconut water. You're getting your potassium, and you're getting your electrolytes, and you're getting, what's very important here, is the nitrate, and hence the nitric oxide. That also helps prevent heart attacks and strokes. So that's good. From the University of Colorado, quote, pediatricians are facing increasing pressure from some parents who want to spread out the recommended vaccine schedule for their children by postponing vaccines, pointing to a need for improved programs that support timely vaccinations, according to a new study by researchers at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. The study published in the current issue of Pediatrics found that almost all pediatricians and healthcare providers encounter requests to spread out vaccines, and that despite risks, increasing numbers of physicians are agreeing to do so. All right, let's take a look at this. It's published in a peer-reviewed journal. It's a major study, and it's showing that virtually all pediatricians, well, Colorado has one of the highest rates of literacy in America. There's a very big health movement in Colorado, and within Colorado, the epicenter, the mecca of health, is Boulder. It's very health conscious. Now, mind you, these are very educated people. So if they're telling their pediatrician, I'm pro-vaccine, but giving my child under a year of age 12 or 16 vaccines, in the scientific literature that I have read shows that that is not right. So I want them spread out over a longer period of time and not bunched all together. Here's the irony, is this is pro-vaccine parents saying the paradigm is wrong, and the pediatricians who are in the forefront of advocating vaccines know it, and they're agreeing to it. That's what this study is showing. Now, of course, there is another step here. Within the autism movement and within the anti-vaccine movement, 95% of all the people, including the leaders of these movements, are all pro-vaccine. Now, they may want safer vaccines. That's simply from my perspective because of not doing their homework. They have focused upon their child receiving a bad vaccine and ending up with side effects, including death or disability. But if they had a chance to revaccinate with the same vaccine but a safer version, they would do it instantly. Well, what keeps a person who heads an autism movement group from going from being pro-vaccine to anti-vaccine, the level of scholarship they're willing to engage in? Speaking with the physicians and pediatricians who are anti-vaccine because they've studied it deeper. There are three physicians, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, Dr. Tony Bark, and Dr. Nancy Banks. These are anti-vaccines. They were all pro-vaccine. And each one has told me that the only reason they went from being pro-vaccine but wanting safer vaccines and anti-vaccine is because they spent thousands of hours reading the literature and saw that the entire field of vaccines is a giant hoax. Now, when they speak with other physicians who are still pro-vaccine and they share the literature with them, then the question is, are those people open to seeing a truth that would challenge their belief systems? And the answer is no. Now, that's a different issue. That is a behavioral issue. Are we willing to see a truth beyond what we perceive to be a truth? Most people, the answer is no. And hence, people, the younger people who are not yet fully indoctrinated into all the different dogmas are really concerned about the safety of vaccines. So they're trying to make vaccines that have never been tested synergistically for safety or efficacy. They want to give them a different schedule. Now the question is, are they willing to watch all the documentaries, read all the scientific articles, and listen to a program I'm doing here on this station tomorrow at noon, where we'll have some information that the public has not been made aware of. I won't say any more than that. It'll be on the subject of vaccines, but I can promise you it should be an enormous embarrassment for the entire medical community, all pro-vaccine scientists, and government agencies. They will all look like complete blithering idiots based on the information we're going to present. It doesn't mean it'll change a single mind. You have to have an open mind for it to change. Closed minds never change. And finally, the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, you can get them from fish, but you can also get them from vegan sources. And you have to be able to know which ones are which and which are your best. If you're going to get them from vegan sources, and I'm getting a lot of requests for information on that, my suggestion is that you use flaxseed, walnut, avocado, chia seed, hemp seed. They're all good sources. Finally, the health benefits of citrus. Now, we all know about orange juice, but citrus, aside from being very tasty, is really nutritionally powerful. Most people think of vitamin C. Think of oranges, tangerines, grapefruits, lemons, limes, and tomatoes. By the way, tomatoes are actually a fruit, and they're an excellent source of bioflavonoids. Vitamin C is pretty good. Bioflavonoids are even better. But most people never get the bioflavonoids because they throw away the peel and the whitish covering that adheres to the fruit sections. But those bioflavonoids are what makes the difference. The word flavonoid is derived from the Latin word flavus, which means yellow. And citrus fruits contain all kinds of disease-fighting flavonoids. They include hesperidin, rutin, quercetin, tangerantin, diosmestin. These are all good. And what do? Well, they help the integrity of your blood vessels. In fact, there was a time when I first came into the field of nutrition that the bioflavonoids were called vitamin P, meaning for permeability of the capillaries. But bioflavonoids are great for dilating your capillaries, helping prevent varicose veins, helping with hemorrhoids, bruising, nosebleeds, bleeding gums, and lymphedema. And just one of these flavonoids is called nobilitine, and it has helped with people with arthritis and Parkinson's disease. And in fact, in one case with Parkinson's, there was a good study and made all the difference in the world. And then we have what is called hesperidin, H-E-S-P-E-R-I-D-I-N. It's really powerful for your brain. It scavenges free radicals and turns off inflammation, and therefore could help people with cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's. So my suggestion is, if you have bruising anywhere on the body, or if you have problems with the brain, that you juice the entire fruit. Skin, peel the whole thing out. It's going to be a little bitter, and especially the seeds. But then add in a teaspoon of manuka honey. So you're getting the benefits of manuka honey, which kills bacteria, and including staph and strep in your throat. But it also helps with the colony of the microorganisms in your intestine. But then you're getting the full spectrum of nutrients for your brain. That's the latest on health and healing. Nice to have you with us. I'm Gary Knoll. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about how root canals could spark autoimmune disease and what you can do to turn that around. And also tomorrow, how our flawed notion of cholesterol has led us on a 50-year journey backwards. But I'm concerned today with the Arctic. All of us should be. According to the latest research from Subhankar Banerjee, the company we should be paying attention to is Royal Dutch Shell. Why? They want to drill in the sea, the Chukchi Sea, and that is really foolish. That is one of the untouched oceanic environments on the planet. But let's be very specific as to why Shell's drilling ambitions are so dangerous. Just think of the way the blowout of one drilling platform, remember British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon, devastated the Gulf of Mexico? Now imagine the same thing happening, but there's no way to clean it up. So forever, you have a gushing oil that would destroy the entire Arctic. I'm sure people in this audience have heard about the sixth extinction, the way at this moment species are blinking off at a historically unprecedented rate. The Arctic seas of Alaska, however, still are sanctuaries, not only for tens of thousands of whales, but also hundreds of thousands of walruses and seals and millions of birds and thousands of polar bears and innumerable fish from more than 100 species, not to mention all the uncharismatic subsea life that eludes our eyes but makes up the food web. Phytoplankton, sea urchins, sand dollars, and sea cucumbers, to name a few. Think of the Arctic Ocean as among the last remaining marine ecological paradises on the planet. Now, for that oil. Looking for it in Arctic waters happens to be the most dangerous form of drilling imaginable. because no proven technology exists that could clean up a major oil spill in distant ice-choked seas in cold and dark and under one of the harshest environments on Earth. But I'm going to be more specific. Even during the brief summer, open water season, ice flows remain a constant threat, as Shell found out in 2012 when one of its drill ships encountered a flow of ice the size of Manhattan and was forced to disconnect from its seafloor anchor and temporarily hold its operations. Deep fog severely restricts visibility. Storms are not exceptions but the norm and are becoming more frequent and violent in a rapidly warming region. It's a forbidding environment for outsiders. As late summer comes, maybe early September, ice begins to form in the seas and darkness descends. Any spill that occurs late in the brief potential drilling season would remain untouched and unattended until the ice melted the following summer. But mind you, 24/7, it's coming out. But even if such a blowout occurred in summer, there's no infrastructure in place to respond to a disaster. The nearest Coast Guard station is 1,000 miles away. And keep in mind that a disaster of this sort would not remain conveniently contained in the Arctic, as a recent U.S. National Research Council study on responding to an Arctic offshore oil spill puts it, quote, the risks of an oil spill in the Arctic presents hazards for the Arctic nations and their neighbors. So add to this potential nightmare scenario another little fact. Shell has garnered a well-deserved reputation as, quote, the company with the spottiest Arctic record. In September 2012, it initiated exploration drilling in U.S. Arctic waters with a conditional permit from the Obama administration, only to end a disastrous year in which one of its two drill rigs, the one that was grounded in the Gulf of Alaska on New Year's Day, the other one called Noble Discoverer, suffered damage after catching fire. While both were fined by the Environmental Protection Agency for violating the Clean Air Act, and the contractor, Noble Drilling, pleaded guilty in 2014 to all 8 felony charges leveled against it for environmental violations, they paid $12.2 million in fines and community service payments. And because of the damage to its rigs, Shell was forced to give up its 2013 drilling plans. A court ruling in January 2014 in favor of local tribes and environmentalists forced the company not to drill that summer either. But since then, the price of oil has plunged, sending a shockwave across the oil industry and deep-sixing all sorts of prospective plans for people to go and drill in the Arctic waters. Norway shelved its 2015 drilling plan in the Barents Sea off that country's northern coast and handed back the 3 leases it had purchased in the Baffin Bay off the west coast of Greenland. Chevron put its plan to drill in Canada's Beaufort Sea on indefinite hold. Following the Ukraine crisis and American sanctions on Russia, ExxonMobil was prohibited from working with the oil company Rosneft on a joint plan to drill in the Kara Sea in the Russian Arctic. Even had these sanctions not been in place, the low price of oil would have made such exploration far less appetizing prospect for the moment. And that's where we stand. So there's just a temporary reprieve. But there's a larger question. Who owns the Arctic Ocean? For more than 4 centuries, Western nations have regarded the Arctic Ocean as an economic treasure chest. The oil harvested from Arctic whales helped fuel the economies of both Europe and North America and drove them, the bowhead whale, to near extinction. It was in February of 1880, the future creator of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, then a 20-year-old medical student, interrupted his studies for a 6-month voyage on the Arctic whaler Hope as the ship's surgeon. And from his diary, we learn that the drive to profit trumped any concern about the possible extinction of the bowhead or Greenland whale. Quote from his diary, price tends to rise steadily for the number of creatures is diminishing. He wrote, probably not more than 300 of them left alive in the whole expanse of the Greenland seas. On another day, he added, the creatures own those unsailed seas. Of course, those seas were anything but unsailed, as commercial ships were plying them to harvest whales. So consider that instead Doyle's euphoric expression of how it felt to him to see life in that ocean. Today, to the extent that the seas can be owned, governments own them and are selling pieces off to the highest bidders, oil companies. Ownership or territorial control for commercial exploitation is, however, only one side of this story of the Arctic Ocean. The magnificent and complex ecology of the northern seas is now being altered by three human cause phenomena: climate change, ocean acidification, and pollution. And Arctic sea life, as we know it, and its ice is vanishing at an astonishing rate thanks to climate change, which is having devastating impacts on the region's polar bears and walruses. In the southern Beaufort Sea of Alaska and Arctic Canada, the polar bear population declined by 40% in the last 9 years. 40% gone, dead. Meanwhile, in six of the last 8 years, tens of thousands of Pacific walruses have hauled themselves out onto barrier islands and tundra along the sea because there was no sea ice left for them to rest on. On shore, walruses are far from their food sources, and young walruses are particularly susceptible to being trampled to death. And commercial whaling in the region, which started in 1848, ended about 1921 when petroleum supplanted oil from the, or I should say the whale oil, as the fuel of choice. With no industrial activity in those waters for more than a half a century, the bowhead population slowly began to recover. Whales don't depend upon sea ice in the way polar bears and walruses do. So in 2011, the bowhead population in the U.S. Arctic was about 17,000, increasing about 3.7% per year. That's a good thing. The half century of commercial calm in the Beaufort Sea ended, however, in the late 1970s when oil exploration began. By the early 1990s, the expensive hunt for oil in Arctic seas had largely failed, and almost all leases were relinquished. The second wave of U.S. Arctic offshore oil and gas exploration only started when George W. Bush took office. And between 2003 and 2008, leases were sold on more than 3 million acres in the Beaufort Sea, while generating substantial controversy and court challenges from the tribal peoples and the environmental groups. The persistence of this resistance to drilling, along with the recent price collapse, has marked the second boom and bust cycle in Arctic exploration. But historically, government-sponsored research on the U.S. Arctic has been driven not by that hallmark of science, curiosity, but by the desire to drill for oil and gas. By that is two impulses that are quite unscientific in nature. The first is an oil company inculcated urge to transform the decision to drill into a sense of inevitability, and the second is an oil company's sponsored urge to rush the process. In fact, according to the National Research Council, oil spill response study, systematic data collection in the Beaufort Sea only began in the late 1970s. In other words, just as the first wave of Arctic offshore oil exploration was revving up, onshore the situation was the same. The initial comprehensive study of the flora and the fauna of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge only took place in the mid-1980s, after the Reagan administration made a push to open it up to development. And while there have only been sporadic studies of the marine environments in question since then, no, I want to underline this, no comprehensive benchmark study for the seas around there has ever been done, nor is there any thorough understanding of how the marine food web works in those seas, or the population sizes and distributions of any but the sentinel species, whales and polar bears and walruses and seals. Even the data on them is considered not reliable or precise enough, according to the National Research Council. So that is what the problem is. And this administration, this president, are so pro-drilling and so pro-corporate interest that they're not willing to keep the Arctic resources underground. The best place for oil and coal, underground, where it belongs. But the moment you can sell leases, and the moment those lobbyists descend, you've got problems. And all that's done behind closed doors, and that's why we should speak out that we do not want any drilling at all for anything in the Arctic. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. States of different cities listening, as well as around the world. We're going to talk for the rest of the show about our global dysfunction and the need for an ethics of holism with Professor Glenn Martin. He is a part of our ongoing series on conversations with remarkable minds. He's professor of philosophy and religious studies at Radford University in Virginia and founder of its program in peace studies. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You have been involved or are involved in the peace organizations in different countries, Costa Rica, Greece, India, and elsewhere, and recently became president of the World Constitution and Parliament Association that is making efforts to create a non-military democratic world under the Constitution for the Federation of Earth Manifesto. By the way, he is also... written numerous articles and books, including Triumph of Civilization, Democracy, Nonviolence, and the Piloting of Spaceship Earth, and the Earth Federation Movement. And his latest book is The Anatomy of a Sustainable World, Our Choice Between Climate Change and Systems Change. His website is radford.edu/gmartin. What do you think about Greece today, finally, being able to have a populist movement in place and immediately being threatened by the European Union that you owe us this money, you're going to have to pay us all this money, we're not giving you any breaks, and the world being angry, the major media being angry that these people, meaning the Greek citizens, actually took back some power from the Troika.
Well, I think it's a very exciting thing that the people of Greece have risen up and said that this is enough. We're sick of this capitalist-imposed austerity program, which is something, as you know, that's going on worldwide. And that's why we struggle for a world transformation, because it's a world problem. It's a systemic problem of the world. That's what we're talking about when we say that we need a democratic constitution for the Federation of Earth.
It's a completely original thought. I witness a sharp division within the progressive movement today. And by a progressive movement, I would include all the many groups and organizations and individuals who are anti-war, environmentalists working against climate change, and struggling for racial and economic justice, and who adamantly oppose the duopoly in Washington's politics and American imperialism. on the one hand, there are those who believe we can make incremental changes in the existing system of governance. That's your corporate Democrats. That's MSNBC. That's The Nation. That's so many publications. I read their articles, and I'm saddened by their lack of insight, because they think, well, we'll just reform this law. We'll get a reformer in there instead of transformer. And on the other hand, there is a smaller contingency who believe we are well beyond the threshold of struggling for small quantitative changes, and the entire system of global governance and corporate free market capitalism needs to be overhauled and replaced outright with what might be called a more integral view of the world and the problems we face. And all of our wars and conflicts today can technically be reduced to the bare elements of national competition and conflicts over resources, and resources that are only absolutely necessary for an unsustainable system and for a failing system of economics and political governance. However, for the average person, particularly in the United States, they are unable to connect all the many dots that point directly towards a system that is totally, intrinsically self-destructive and is now threatening the lives of billions of people. So take your time and please juxtapose these two worldviews, the fragmented view that believes incremental changes can save us from catastrophe, and then the holistic view that realizes that not only when the entire system is recognized as faulty, can real change then begin?
Yes, I think you lay out the alternatives very nicely. And that's why I don't, as much as I admire the people of Greece, I don't think it's going to make much difference in the ultimate scheme of things. The world system that we, as we encounter it, and I was listening just a few minutes ago to your account of the British imperialism around the world. It is truly frightening, you know, and that the British were the global hegemon prior to the power being centered primarily in the United States, and today it's in the United States, which is the global hegemon. And what this world system is an integral conjunction of global capitalism, global corporate capitalism, with the power of the imperial nation states. In the case of the United States, it has its allies in Britain and some of the European states, and the system is pervasive. It's globalized. It's been globalized for at least a century now, but of course, with this new concept of globalization, the propaganda system tells us that, oh, there's something inevitable, that we've got to have this free market in the world system, and they tell people that you can make a difference in politics within the United States, or politics within Greece, or a struggle in Venezuela for the people to take back their government. But it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless we human beings, and this is where I liked your phrase holism that you used a moment ago, Gary. It's not going to happen unless we human beings, who realize that we're all the same on this planet, we all have the same fundamental needs, we all need to act with reason and compassion and create a decent world order. That's when it's going to happen. We have to decide that the 5% who now own more than 50% of the global wealth are not going to ruin our planet and ruin our lives. And that's why we work for non-military democratic world government, because the only force, The only authority, legitimate authority, that could possibly transform the world would be a government that's over the nation states, that can, by law, systematically disarm them, and a government that is over the global transnational corporations, that can, by law, require them to act sustainably and for the common good.
I appreciate those insights. Let's go one step further in what you're speaking about, because many listeners will not have heard of the Earth Constitution, which advocates the need to think globally about our planet's challenges and threats. Would you please speak more about that? And then, as a philosopher and scholar in religious studies, how can a person make the qualitative leap in a mindset from a fragmented worldview to a global holistic view?
It's true that many people have not heard of the Earth Constitution, although it is rapidly becoming known throughout the world. But this movement goes, it isn't new. The movement goes back to the First World War. Some of the leaders of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom that was founded in 1915 were decrying the First World War as a war of sovereign militarized nation states, recognizing no effective law above themselves, just struggling for power in the world. And that was, as far as a movement is concerned, that was the beginning of the World Federalist Movement, where people began to say, we need democratic world government. We need a law over these nations that can give us a decent world for everybody. The Constitution of the Federation of Earth came out of this groundswell of activism that was there very actively between the two world wars, and then came to a culmination after the Second World War. There were many, many people who were world federalists. Albert Einstein was one. Emory Reeves, a number of serious thinkers said, Albert Camus in his famous essay, Neither Victims Nor Executioners, they were all saying we need a world parliament over everybody. The founders of the Earth Constitution organized beginning in 1958, and worked worldwide to bring hundreds of world citizens together, international lawyers, academics, thinkers, and they met beginning in 1968 in four constituent assemblies in various cities around the world and worked together to write this constitution. It was finally finished in 1991 in a big meeting in Troia, Portugal, and since 1991, our organization, the World Constitution and Parliament Association, has offered this constitution to the world as an alternative that can transform our world system and give us a real future on this planet. How can people, now your second question, how can people spiritually make this kind of transition? I think that it is happening all over the world. A number of psychologists, a number of visionary thinkers and progressive thinkers have been talking about human beings going through stages of consciousness where our consciousness transmutes. It becomes more and more mature, more and more universal, more and more compassionate. Carol Gilligan, for example, in her book, In a Different Voice, talks about a stage of maturity that she calls universalistic, and then a higher stage which she calls integral. Right? People are beginning to realize worldwide that we need to begin thinking holistically and thinking as one species on this planet. One set of human beings who all have the same needs and have a finite, fragile planet that we have to preserve and save for ourselves and for future generations. I would like to suggest that spiritually this is in the air. And in our organization, the World Constitution and Parliament Association, which has chapters in many countries, we have people who are Muslims who think that this is what the Quran was ultimately talking about, a decent world of peace and respect and diversity for everyone. We have people who are Christians who think that this is a preliminary to bringing the kingdom of God on earth, which was the message of Jesus. And we have people who are atheists who say, This holism is scientifically proven, which it is. The holism of the Earth is a planet, the holism of human beings, and we can move from that holism to create a new world system that serves everybody in the future generations.
I'd like to ask you something as a philosopher now, all right? I watched a movie the other night called American Sniper, and it, for me it was disturbing. Because I saw how everyone in the audience packed was cheering this person on, and I heard their comments as we were leaving the theater. It portrays a very disturbing and dysfunctional code of ethics built upon the values of hatred towards the other. No questioning that. No questioning whether the other deserves to die, why we were in their land, were there any justifying factors? What would happen, for example, if you heard that the Russians or Chinese or someone had invaded Texas? Do you think that people would rebel? Do you think they would become insurgents against this invasion? No discussion whatsoever. It was just black and white. To me, these are perverted values. And they're not uncommon among many Americans, particularly the radical extremes of Christianity and extreme Zionism. And the majority of the Republican Party. And they're the values of American exceptionalism, which I deplore, and the imperialist domination. These are individuals and groups who only believe in scientific facts that confirm their pet beliefs that are fundamentally selfish, tribal, and exclude all who disagree with them. And it's an epidemic in climate change denialism. On the other hand, science and what is now emerging as a new metaphysics confirms what you just mentioned, that human survival relies upon harmony rather than conflict and discord. And genetics proves that all people are interconnected. Evolutionary biology has now shown that our species evolves not through survival of the fittest, that is a myth, but through survival through cooperation. Now, these contribute to what you have called an ethics of holism. So please speak further on this new ethical code based upon science and metaphysical observation of the world and ourselves, and what it is it, and why it's critical that more and more people embrace holistic ethical values.
I've got a book that's going to be out in the spring that's going to be about holism. And it's called Renaissance, the New Philosophical Holism and Our Global Social Contract. In that book, I look at the literature, starting with the scientific literature. And as I think you're pointing out correctly, beginning in 1905 with Einstein's special theory of relativity, the cosmologists have begun to realize that the universe itself is an integral whole. And then with the development of quantum physics, they have discovered this holism at the tiniest microparticle level, that there's no such thing as building blocks of the universe, that everything is interconnected in a dynamic unities. Anthropology, as you're pointing out, they have discovered scientifically that every human being is genetically almost identical with every other human being, and that all these differences that fragment us, national differences, cultural differences, racial differences, and so on, they're really just insignificant, completely insignificant as far as our unity as human beings is concerned. And then, of course, finally, and again, scientifically corroborated at great length, has been the discovery of the unity of the planetary biosphere. The fact that on this finite planet, all the forces that operate, from the sunlight coming in to the oceans to the air to the ecosystems to the living things, all these elements of our biosphere are delicately woven into a holism, an ecological holism that we are rapidly destroying, and with our capitalism and our refusal to understand this to convert to a holistic point of view and so on. So I think that's very, very much this kind of transformation of our consciousness.
We're out of time for now, unfortunately. But we look forward to reading The Anatomy of a Sustainable World, Our Choice Between Climate Change and Systems Change, and also your new upcoming book on holism and holism models of existence, coexistence. Thank you very much for all your great work, Professor Glenn Martin, Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Radford University in Virginia. Appreciate you being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. I feel good. I knew that I would not. So good, so good. I got a year. Oh, I feel nice. A sugar and spine. I feel nice. A sugar and spine.